from the great earthquake of 1964 to the great oil spill of 1989. I will introduce the participants in our discussion today. Each will then make a presentation, if they so desire, on the spill and current cleanup efforts. I request that you write down your questions and wait until after the presentation to ask them. I plead with you to try and quell as much negativity as you can find in your heart to do, and direct your efforts towards assisting in restoring our environment and our lives to their normal states. Remember, if 1,000 of us collect 1,000 gallons, each for 10 days, we got it all. After the presentations, we will invite questions from the audience. You may direct your questions to an individual on stage or to the entire group. I will ask you to display the same courtesy that you would like shown to yourself. Do not interrupt the speaker, and please don't disrupt the presentation by anything other than laughter. Let's show the world our indomitable Alaskan spirit. Not the case. I hope they send somebody, however, but we don't have anybody here yet, and as soon as they hear, I'm sure they'll come in with great fanfare. And somebody stole my cheat sheet. We have the Coast Guard signing in here, I see. Okay, I will start with, all the way on my left, we have Dan Warren from Prince William Sound Aquaculture Corporation, better known to us as PISWAC. To his right is Commander Stephen McCall, Captain of the Port and Federal On-Scene Coordinator of the U.S. Coast Guard. Next, I have to a gentleman and a lady from the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. I have Manny Suarez and Colleen Berg. Then that's my seat over here. To my right, I have four gentlemen from Fish and Game. All the way on this end here, I have Kim Sundberg, who represents Habitat Division. James Brady, our own regional biologist from Cordova. Ken Flory, who is director of the Division of Commercial Fisheries. Don Collinsworth, commissioner of Alaska Department of Fish and Game. And then I have two representatives from National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, namely Steve Zimmerman, who is chief of the Office of Marine Mammals and Endangered Species, rather a mouthful, and Jackie Michelle, who is of the scientific support team. And I think I will start from the right and have Jackie give us a brief overview of NOAA's view and perspective of this spill. Thank you, Jackie.
Last introduced, first presented. I was always betting I was going to be last. I'm Jackie Michelle. I'm part of NOAA. We're part of the team that provides support to the Coast Guard during oil spills. We're part of a nationwide team that brings together experts in oil spill trajectories, modeling, impact assessments, and cleanup strategies. What I want to do is I have some very few copies of some materials about where the oil is today. I know you're not going to be able to see this. But let me describe it to you. This is the result of an overflight. Most of the oil has moved to the western part of the sound. It's heavy concentrations around Naked Island, between Naked Island and the north part of Night Island. There's the largest part of the sheen of the oil slick seems to be just west of the area between Naked Island and Eleanor Island. There are also heavy streamers and heavy sheens all the way down south of Smith Island, but it seems to be several miles short of reaching Green Island. The winds for the next couple of days, let me read you the forecast, for Tuesday, March, until Wednesday around 5 o'clock, small craft advisories, winds out of the north at 25 knots, diminishing to 15 knots Wednesday afternoon. The winds should be stronger to 35 knots out of the bays and the passages. What this is doing is driving the oil in a southwesterly trajectory, and that's going in the passage, Night Island Passage. And our observations from today is that the oil is not coating much of the shoreline. It's running parallel to the shoreline, which is good. We're minimizing the amount of oil that's contaminating the shoreline. Now, once it reaches the very southern part of Night Island, Night Passage, there's a series of islands that it may have heavy contamination like it did along the north part of Night Island. So we're real concerned about where the oil is likely to come ashore. If we continue to have the oil stay in a coherent mass and move in this area between the islands and out to sea, that will minimize the amount of shoreline contamination and get it flushed out of Prince William Sound the quickest possible way. What we're going to be doing in the next couple of days is continue to monitor where the slicks are and try to project where they will be going over the period, next couple of periods of time. We're trying to feed this information back into Exxon. They're using our models and our overflight data for their projections, and then using that to where they should be placing boom in the future. However, as we all know, in these kind of sea conditions, booms do not work. They're not an effective protection or containment device when you have seas up to 6 feet and winds to this speed. So we don't expect any of the booms to be very effective for the time being in these high weather conditions, unless it's further up back in the cove. And that's been some of our strategy, is to identify the most sensitive areas where the hatcheries are, where the important salmon streams are, and try to place booms back inside the coves where we think that will keep any oil that gets inside the coves to not contaminate the shoreline. And our biggest concern along the shoreline contamination, because this, once the shoreline is contaminated, that may be a secondary source for ongoing contamination, especially as the herring season starts to increase in volume.
Thank you, Jackie. Steve.
I'm Steve Zimmerman, work with marine mammals out of the Juneau office of the National Marine Fisheries Service. About the only thing I can say with certainty at this point is of the 10 to 12,000 sea otters that occupy Prince William Sound, some of them are probably going to go to sea otter heaven in the next few days. Expecting quite that much enthusiasm, to tell you the truth. The we're not on the other side of that issue. We're not expecting at this point as much impact to the sea lions or to the harbor seals or to any of the cetaceans. But we really don't know what's going to happen with those animals. I'll just tell you that we've got a fixed wing plane, a helicopter, and a boat out there each day. The fixed wing and the helicopter are surveying the areas both in front of the oil and behind the oil. We've mapped the distribution of most of the animals before the oil got to them, and we're going to be following the behavior of those animals. I doubt if we'll find a whole lot of dead ones because you don't have a lot of beach over there for the animals to strand on. The way we'll note that they're gone is probably going to be through surveys. They just won't be there in the future. The boat has two people on it. It's the Resolution, and they'll be going around looking from the water for the distribution of animals and trying to collect any dead ones they may find. Noting your enthusiasm a few seconds ago, I guess I won't go into the sea otter rehabilitation and cleaning program that's been set up in Valdez, but there is such a thing, and I guess I'll tell them not to list their phone number. That's all I have. And I'll be pleased to answer questions.
Thank you, Steve. Commissioner Collinsworth?
Thank you. My name is Don Collinsworth. I'm the commissioner of the Department of Fish and Game. I've been to Cordova lots of times. Sometimes they were difficult situations we came to address in terms of management of fisheries. But even as difficult as those times were, they don't approach the difficulties that we face today. I'd like to give you just a little bit of an overview of some of the activities in the department, that I'm going to defer to James Brady, our area management biologist, who just returned late this afternoon. from Valdez and made a survey overflight on his way in, so he has more recent information than I do. There certainly will be others on this panel that can talk to you about the response, the initial response for the oil containment cleanup, and where we stand presently with regard to the spill. But I'd like to take a couple minutes just to tell you about some of the things that we in the Department of Fish and Game are going to do and have done. We, of course, are participants on the regional response team, and as soon as we were notified of the event, what I guess the oil companies call it, an event, we responded by sending our people to Valdez and coordination with the Department of Environmental Conservation. Were the initial state response, along with the Department of Natural Resources, and have been working through the regional response team in trying to make determinations with regard to most sensitive zones that required initial protection and the use of chemical dispersants and other issues. So we essentially are approaching this in, from three different groups. We had the initial response group that looked at the problem, immediate problem of the spill and how we were going to deal with that. I have also established a separate task force within the agency and have pulled in what I consider to be some of my top hands to put together an oil impact assessment plan and an organization for both the immediate response to assess the immediate impact as well as the long-term and residual effects of this occurrence. The head of that team is Dr. John Clark. Dr. Funk, Dr. Cruz, Dr. Edgars are also members of that that group. They're in Valdez presently meeting with the scientists that are on the scene from the other agencies, and we'll be putting together a very thorough and comprehensive plan for immediate monitoring and assessment and long-term monitoring and assessment. While I initially had them report to Valdez because that is where most of the scientists are right now, we will be moving that operation to Cordova, and we will then headquarter that assessment effort out of Cordova until we hit a point at which we find that there's no longer a need to take any samples, or we hit some kind of a threshold where we make a determination that the periodicity of the sampling is less frequent than, and over a longer period of time, but we'll be back, I'm sure, for a long period of time. The third group is our fisheries management group, which will be, of course, headquartered here. I'll be here. The director of the Commercial Fisheries Division will be here. We'll be working with the regional supervisor from Anchorage is here, Ken Florey. James Brady, is, of course, is an area management biologist, and we'll be working with him, bringing in all of the resources that we need to monitor and make some determinations about how and when we're going to approach this series of fisheries that we have coming. As you all know, that when the sound kicks off, there's just a series of fisheries right on through into the late summer coho fisheries. So we have a number of decision points that are facing us very soon. We just came back from, just came over from a meeting over at the grade school where we met with the pound operators, and we are trying to determine what the, when decisions have to be made to allow that operation either to go or no-go. And those operators indicated that they need a decision by the 1st of April. We'll certainly try to be as responsive as we can and make the decision by that time. But this is a fairly dynamic situation that we have going out here in the Sound, and it's changing rapidly. But we try to make that decision because we have kelping operations in the southeast that have to precede the actual seining of the herring and putting them in the pounds. So we have a kind of a three-pronged approach. We still have people working the regional response team. That's headed up by our habitat deputy director, Bruce Baker, who's in Valdez. We have this impact assessment task force that I put together. and then we have our fisheries management task force. So those are three different levels, and of course we'll be interacting with one another consistently. We see this as one of our major obligations in the department is to chronicle this event from day one through whatever date. And that may be a long time into the future, and we're staffing this as a separate task force. We have obviously have fisheries that are going to be conducted around the state. We have scant enough staff to cover those, so we'll be pulling people in that we can at this time, and then we'll be going to some temporary hires to get enough people on the scene to do the sample and the research work. We have been coordinating with DEC. The lab in Palmer is being prepared to do our bioassay work. We have worked with the National Marine Fisheries Service, the lab out of the Northwest Alaska Fisheries Center. I talked to the director there this morning. And we'll be getting folks from the Northwest Alaska Fisheries Center out of Seattle. The Auk Bay Lab, which is an annex to the center, will be providing some experts as well. I've talked to the regional director several times of the National Marine Fisheries Service, Steve Benoyer. And Steve used to be a deputy commissioner in my agency, so we have a good close working relationship. I've talked to Walt Stiglitz from the Fish and Wildlife Service, and we'll be working with the marine mammals and seabirds on the mammal side with them, but our principal focus and efforts are going to be in dealing with the marine life. I'm sure that you'll have some questions. I'm going to ask James Brady to come up next. As I said, he has just returned from Valdez and has been there since Friday and has more recent information. I got flight delayed out of Juneau today. We had a snowstorm in there, so I sat in the plane for 3 hours and I didn't get here and till late this afternoon, and have not had an opportunity to sit down with the staff. Jim just got in, I guess, about 5:30 or 6:30, and so we have not even had an opportunity to sit down and discuss where we are at this point. That's about all I have at this time. We'll be certainly happy to answer any questions you have. Would like to ask Jim Brady to come up next.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Well, I think we've all had better times. It's been nice to come home to Cordova, and to a certain degree, this has really brought home to me the whole impact of the situation that we're facing. I went to Valdez and been involved in the whole process over there, and I think everyone over there has been on an adrenaline high the past 5 days, and we've been surviving on about 3 hours sleep at night, and the momentum and the activities that are going on over there, and coming here and seeing a lot of friends and familiar faces, and the concern, the faces really brings home just exactly what we're facing and the severity of the situation. At about 5:40 a.m. on Friday, I had a call, woke me up, and gave me the news. And at that time, I woke up and took a while to really have the whole thing set in. I called up Cordova Air Service and set up a flight, and Sam Shar and I flew out at 7 a.m. and took a look at the situation. I think the initial impact is something that you can't really put to words. It is pretty amazing to see 230,000 barrels of oil, water in Prince William Sound all in one time. After that flight, I returned here and made a few phone calls. We did some initial planning. I did some discussions. Had some discussions with my staff, and then returned to Valdez that afternoon and surveyed how the oil had changed at that time. And that was about the time that the rate of flow of oil out of the tanker was starting to slow down. But when we looked at it at 7 a.m., it was still coming out at a rapid pace, and by later that afternoon, it had started to slow down significantly. From that point, there was a lot of things happening, and with the various agencies arriving on the grounds, and Alyeska at that time was mobilizing. Just the first, the key people from Exxon were starting to arrive on the scene. And my main function through this whole process, starting from that point, has been to work really with the tactical response people and provide local knowledge and how we're going to best approach this thing, how to make decisions in terms of deployment of some of the tools they have to respond to the oil spill, and basically work initially with the scientific community there on a lot of the organization and the direction of where we're going to go in terms of the assessment and evaluation work, monitoring programs, and whatnot. The department has a habitat staff there right now that is basically the department's biggest arm there at this point. And again, our primary focus has been in the interaction with the tactics to this point, and now more so we're blending in with the science that's taking place there. Kim Sundberg, who's at the table with me, is with the Habitat Division. I think he can tell you how we've put together our initial habitat monitoring programs. As I said, when I had some initial discussions with the staff here in Cordova, and we determined how we were going to approach this, one of the things at that time we didn't have any clear funding committed or anything like that. We just had the knowledge that this was the big one and that we had to do everything we could for it. And but by the same token, we recognized that there were a lot of important things going on in Prince William Sound that we couldn't abandon. So what we did at that time is we deployed the Montague out and have commenced our regular pre-emergent fry index program for the pink and chum salmon, and use that as a platform initially for the habitat work as well from the Virgin Bay area. We've decided that we didn't want to give up our ongoing programs, such as the pre-emergent work, the herring spawn deposition program, things such as this, where we have a long-term database. Because we felt that, in actuality, that those are probably going to be some of the most important tools that we have in terms of long-term evaluation of the impacts of this. So we've continued these programs, and now, as the commissioner indicated, we are building a real strong research team that's going to go in and tackle the bigger problem of just exactly what are the short-term and long-term impacts of this event going to be on the Prince William Sound fisheries resources. There's been a lot of spinning of wheels over there, a lot of disorganization, a lot of people trying to get a lot of work done without much direction. But I think overall there's really been an incredibly stimulating atmosphere there, particularly in the scientific community, and a lot of amazing things have really been pulled together. There's been a real excellent and commendable sense of interagency cooperation for the all the agencies that are represented here, the NOAA folks, the National Marine Fisheries Service, within the state DEC, even within the Department of Fish and Game Habitat. There are a lot of people that that have never been brought together, and yet we have established a real good working relationship. The NOAA folks, I think, are to be commended for a lot of the initial scientific organization. They have put together a nightly scientific meetings where all the research the team leaders from the resource agencies get together and get up to speed as to what their programs are and what everyone else's programs are, how those are fitting into the situation as a whole. And this has been very helpful in that we've eliminated duplication of effort and have also been able to identify data gaps, areas that aren't being evaluated. One of the things that really isn't being evaluated is the impact to the fisheries resource. And this is something that's it's not easy to evaluate. It's going to take a major program, and that's why I'm happy that the commissioner could report to you tonight the magnitude of the program we are preparing to tackle this situation with. As he indicated, we have the most talented biometric staff and research staff within the department that are heading up this program, and I think it's going to be an excellent scientific study to provide us with some real hard data of exactly what the impacts of this event have been to the commercial fishing industry as well as the resource itself. Some other interesting things have happened in terms of the response to the oil cleanup efforts and that sort of thing. And in this regard, I'd like to extend some recognition to the folks from CDFU. There's been, I feel, some good cooperation again among agencies and groups, and this is again improved dramatically through time. Last night there was a coalition developed between the Coast Guard and the state. Coast Guard representing the federal interests, Commissioner of DEC representing state interests, including the Department of Fish and Game, and the Exxon folks. This is to direct really the operations for the program from this point on. There's a steering committee that is composed of the Admiral, and again, Steve may want to expand on this more, the Admiral from the Coast Guard, again, Denny Kelso, Commissioner of DEC, and Frank Iarossi from the President of Exxon. Below this steering committee, they developed a second organizational layer or level that incorporates representatives, the key tactical people from Exxon in terms of their operation to the response, ADF&G folks, DEC folks, and also we've got Jack Lamb from CDFU as a member of this second level committee. And I'd like to share with you what the CDFU people have accomplished in terms of responding to the situation over the past day and a half or so, and their involvement and inclusion in this group has been very instrumental. As you know, the oil has been moving at a rapid pace as a result of the high winds we've had out of at Evaldi's arm, and the response team really has been playing catch-up the whole time, and I think we've been somewhat nearsighted on what's going on, at least some of the meetings and some of the initial responses, when in fact the, you know, the magnitude of this situation is so large that we were to the point that we really had to look at what were the most critical things, rather than worrying about falcon nests and small critical habitat areas. We're to the point where we're trying to do everything we could to save the ship. And the CDFU folks there provided some input, I think, that really helped us all bring this to light. And when I'm saying us all, I'm talking about all of the agencies. And what we have done right now in terms of the response tactics identified really our most valuable resources that are currently in the path of the oil slick as it's progressing in the southwestern district of Prince William Sound. And those are the hatchery areas, the Armonette Coring Hatchery is identified as really the most important of these areas, followed then by the Main Bay Hatchery and the Ishami Lagoon area. And what we've decided to do with this working group is last night was to identify these areas and really determine that this was our last line of defense, and that our best use of the existing boom materials that were available in the area were really to protect these three critical areas. And as a result, a major effort was founded, and again, the CDFU folks mobilized a lot of vessels out of Cordova. There was rendezvous with Naked Island and deployment of a lot of this equipment, particularly in the Main Bay and Main Bay area. And again, I don't know, I don't have the end of the day activity report on that. Perhaps Jack does, but I think that we were to the point where this was really the appropriate action, and I think it was a good move to make at that time. The other thing that I know that everyone is most considered or concerned about that I have to comment on here, I made a few notes on the airplane as I was flying in, and I really didn't have much time to put any thought to this, but I know the main thing people are concerned about right now is how we're going to go about determining whether or not we're going to even be able to have commercial fisheries, and we're getting a lot of questions. You know, are we going to proceed with the pound fishery, or have all of our fisheries been lost? And all I can say at this time is that we have a tremendous resource here, and we're going to do everything in the world to protect it and protect its reputation in the marketplace. And we are amassing a number of research programs, a number of evaluation programs, so that we can collect the information in order to make that determination. We want to make sure that if in fact we feel that we cannot proceed with a fishery, whether it is the pound fishery or any of the other fisheries that occur in the sequence of fisheries that we have starting here in April and going through October, that we have a very solid justification for our decision on whether to proceed or whether not to proceed. We're looking at our primary concern, obviously, being the preservation of the resource, the health of the stocks, and Also, we're very concerned with the quality standards of product that will be coming out of Prince William Sound. We want to make sure that we don't allow tainted product to be harvested and marketed this year and jeopardize the outstanding reputation that Prince William Sound has built for itself in the production of fisheries products. So we'll be working, as the commissioner indicated, with a number of groups and laboratories, DEC and sampling labs, to go through this evaluation process. And I've had the assurance that we will have a high priority in terms of our needs in this regard, and so that we can get the fastest possible turnaround time on samples that we send into these laboratories for evaluation, and we'll have the support of really the state's experts in providing myself and the management staff with the information we need to make these determinations. So at this time, we're not anywhere close to being prepared to give you the go, no-go answer on any of the fisheries, but we're mobilizing this process whereby we'll be able to evaluate that and have a good, solid foundation in terms of data to support that ultimate decision. That really concludes all I have to say. We've got well, thanks. That really feels good.
Thank you, James. Our technicians inform me that they have to do some very quick adjustments to the mic here.
You're listening to a live broadcast of a town meeting being held in Cordova, Alaska. Members of the community are being addressed by representatives of various regulatory agencies involved and industry representatives involved with the Exxon grounding and respond. We're going to go back to that Cordova conference now.
I'd appreciate it. So we'll allow Don the stage now.
This is a teleconference circuit, so there is some cutting out that's due to the teleconference unit being used.
I realize that, and I apologize. And I appreciate the opportunity to be over here with you tonight. I know you have a lot of questions of Exxon, and I will do my very best to answer as many of them as I can. And first, I'd like to make a brief statement. Mr. Brady has covered a lot of what's going on in the fisheries, but just to try to fill you in a little bit on what we're doing on the oil spill cleanup.
If I could interrupt for a moment, can everybody hear Mr. Cornett from back there? If you could speak up just a little, I think it would be appreciated.
Okay. Can you hear me in the back now? Thank you. I'm not going to go back into the history. I'm going to give you the report that we have today on what has happened today and where we stand. I'll be glad to answer any questions that you have that I can answer. Two committees were established yesterday to oversee the cleanup operation. A steering committee of three includes Exxon, the Coast Guard, and the State of Alaska. The operating committee consists of representatives of Exxon, the Coast Guard, state agencies, and the fishing industry, including the Alaska Chugach Corporation. And I met with those people this morning, and the environmental person, Stacy, forget her last name, but she is on our operating committee now. These committees will work to define priority cleanup areas, develop plans for conducting cleanup of specific areas, and remain flexible to respond to changing conditions. Dr. Ronald Goodman, a remote sensing expert, has arrived today and is involved in a flyover today to assist in tracking the oil. Uncooperative weather Monday with wind gusts up to 70 miles per hour delayed all cleanup operations by over 30 hours. Full cleanup operations began at daybreak. In response to high wind warning Sunday, Exxon moved to secure all skimming operations and get the crews to a safe location. All the skimming equipment is intact. However, the containment boom around the vessel was damaged and is essentially back in place, and it is back in place now. Booms are being moved to Main Bay, Ashami Bay, and Evans Island. I apologize if I don't pronounce these words right. Where sensitive fisheries, as identified by the operating committee, are located. The total number of skimmers currently in use is 12. Six additional skimmers are in various states of readiness, and we have skimmed up to this morning 3,500 barrels from the surface. The report that we get for today's work is generated late at night, and we have two press conferences a day in Valdez, and we give this information out at the first press conference at 11 o'clock each morning. We were able to drop one dispersant load of 5,500 gallons in Zone 1 yesterday afternoon with EPA permission. Dispersants were spread today around the ship in Zone 1 also. And burning of free oil was being planned for Eleanor Island today. I don't know if it took place or not. I won't know until I get back to the meeting. Exxon has about 200 people available, 120 from BECO and at least 50 from NORCON to conduct the cleanup effort. The crews were unable to operate Monday, as I said, due to weather conditions, but were fully active today. This is the first real good full day of work we've been able to complete with that many people. We intend to hire
are tuned in live to the Cordova Town Meeting via the teleconference lines. There seems to be a little bit of a problem with it. We'll try and stay with them.
Steve Hammack in Valdez announcing that the Alaskan Bridge operator has been able to reconnect Cordova. We now return with our coverage of the conference call connection of the Cordova Town Meeting. With representatives of Exxon and the regulatory agencies.
At this point, but because of the need for crude oil down in the lower 48. The responsibility is the safety of the vessel. We're trying to ensure that the vessel is lightered off slowly, cautiously, properly. If you make a mistake when you're transferring the oil off the ship, it's very difficult to recover. So we're very, very cautious in what we're doing and trying to get the oil out of the ship. And then once the oil is out of the ship, that alleviates the pollution problem, but I still have a large ship that's sitting on a pinnacle problem. So there's a lot of naval architecture folks and studying going on to ensure that when the ship does come off, that reef that it's on, it comes off the way we want it to, and then we're going to be taking it to a location for temporary repairs here and then eventually for permanent repairs down south. Concerning the oil spill, obviously this is the largest oil spill of oil in United States history. And it's only one-fifth of the oil that still is on the ship. We've seen that mechanical oil spill recovery and quantities of oil like this are very, very limited in their capabilities. Even on the best of circumstances, weather-wise, Saturday and Sunday, getting equipment out there, and even when equipment is out there, having it make a hole or a dent in the oil that's out there is very, very slow. Which is one of the reasons that the regional response team, a bunch of federal state agencies working together, developed this oil spill dispersant plan, which is what I'm leading to right now, dispersants. We've heard a lot about them, good, bad, and informed and uninformed. And I answered a lot of questions this afternoon in Valdez because a lot of people in Valdez are concerned about dispersants What are we doing? Why are we using them? Why are we not using them? There are zones developed in Prince William Sound that are agreed upon all these different agencies, and there's been input from a lot of folks in, some folks in Cordova, that there's a zone one in the middle of the tanker lanes, which means I have the authority without discussing with anybody to use dispersants in that portion of Prince William Sound. The reason for using dispersants in that portion of Prince William Sound would be because the oil is going to be going to out of that deep center portion of Prince William Sound and possibly going where it went, or into Walker Bay, any other place where it's the water is not as deep and there's not as much of a mixing bowl to dilute the oil and water mixture. As no one has the authority to do, was a heavy burden because if this person's in a quantity that would have an effect on the amount of oil in Prince William Sound during this release would involve a tremendous amount of oil dispersion. That's the main reason why we're taking so many tests. We've heard about testing before we actually used large quantities of dispersants. We wanted to make sure they were going to work. And we found out that they worked, and we had a plan to do something on Monday, and then the wind got too strong and blew the oil away. There was some pressure yesterday to use dispersants in areas in the way of Night Island. We went up, took a look at it, and I told everybody no, it wouldn't work. So there were some dispersants used. There were some dispersants used today, because there was some oil coming off the ship. It was fresh oil, new oil, and the opportunity was there, and it worked. The other technology that's being attempted to be used to try to slow down the oil is burning. I guess what I'm saying is it's a very frustrating job from my end, from the other resource agencies, to combat a quantity of oil such as was spilled in Prince William Sound.
Nelson from Alyeska presents something to us now just for a few minutes. I'm afraid he's also on the plane that's taking off in short order, so immediately after this...
I do want to apologize for being late, but there was a series of meetings in Valdez that people had to participate. Can you hear me in the back of the room?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you for your hospitality, as we say. I do not have a long prepared statement. I'm a lot taller than the rest of these folks. That's good, because I think the real meat of it is the questions. I'll try to answer your questions as best I can. I do not have all the details, as you might expect. The people who have the details are busy working at the terminal, and you can rest assured that there will be a very extensive investigation. I'm quite sure by many different groups, including Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, because the thing we want to do is learn from what has happened here. Some things obviously didn't work as well as we would hope, but we are going to learn, and we do not want this to happen again. Let me quickly just run through some of the things that we do. We have three tugs, as you all know. We got the notice from the Coast Guard shortly after midnight of some kind of tanker difficulty hitting a rock. Shortly after that, we dispatched a tug, as our plan calls for, is my understanding, out to the site to see if the tanker needed assist. And as you know, it's about 25, 30 miles out there, say 25, and it got out there in approximately 2 hours. The second tug, we set that out a little bit later with the lightering equipment, the hoses. Again, that's part of the way we work this. And then the third one goes with the barge. Now, the barge had been damaged in the high winds of a couple weeks ago, I'm informed, and we had unloaded to fix it. So we had to put the booming equipment and the skimming equipment back on board. And so we were a number of hours later than we wanted to at getting out to the site. But very frankly, to tell you, in a spill of this size, 240,000 barrels, I believe, is the amount, and the speed with which it was released, there is no way that this equipment, booming or skimming, could make a difference at that juncture. What the booming says simply at that point is get the booms in place across the sensitive areas before the oil gets there. And that responsibility was taken over. The other thing we do is we call everybody. There's a long, long list of people we call to alert and to start the resources coming, including, for example, Beagert Aviation in Tucson or Phoenix, wherever it is, that has the dispersant spraying equipment. And that was a couple hours after the spill to come and running. And of course, calling the owners of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline and talking with Mr. Iorossi and other people, making any and every commitment called for in the plan to start the resources coming toward the site. And then the way this works under the Clean Water Act, as I think many of you are aware, the spiller is responsible for the cleanup. And that's Exxon Shipping Company. And they showed up on site, Mr. Iorossi, late Friday afternoon, and had his first news conference at roughly 6. And very shortly after that was in total control, at least from the industry viewpoint, a poor choice of words. He was the one in charge of making the effort of the cleanup. And any and all those questions, of course, would be responded. What happened then and what's going on would be answered by Exxon. So that's where we are today. The port has opened up, or more correctly, I should say, the first tanker came in today, left Knowles Head about 6:30, the Marco Sag River. There's another one, I believe, on the way, the OMI Columbia, and the way they're working it was with two tugs escorting it, dodging the oil, I am told. And they bring one in and take one out. There were two tankers, as you know, in port when this tragedy occurred. So that's the way it's operating. If any of you are interested in the throughput numbers or that kind of thing, we can cover that in the question and answer period. So I'll sit down, or we'll start the questions now. Or did you have more?
Well, I think probably the burning question here today, right now, is why is tanker traffic continuing through Valdez Arm? We haven't mastered this skill. We haven't proven that we can prevent another, and we're afraid of this problem being compounded. Could you address that, please?
Well, in part, the Coast Guard makes the decision on opening the port. As you would expect, we would like to start the traffic up. We believe it can be handled safely under the conditions it's being done. Like I say, it's being escorted by two of the tugs, and it is, I think, it is doing it in daylight hours, but I am not sure exactly what the schedule is. Perhaps, Steve, you can comment on that. He would have more of the facts about that. Daylight hours, yeah, daylight hours.
and avoiding the oil slick to the maximum extent possible, I believe, is the way it's working. I don't know if that was policy 5 years ago. I do. Yes, thank you, sir. I will tell you just in a minute.
Let's take the questions in an orderly fashion, please. If you could hold your hand up, and a microphone will come to you, and you can stand and read your question, and then an answer will be provided to you. I see a paper waving right here.
My question is for Mr. Coronet. The first part of my question, is it going to take 20 years to settle claims in this instance as in France? Second part, Mr. Coronet, how much is your way of life worth to you?
I'll take the second one first. It's not very much tonight. This is my fourth press conference today, and if I sound a little sluggish, it's just because I haven't slept in a while. Yeah, I'm not trying to get your sympathy. And
what was the first question? First question, is it going to take 20 years to settle these claims as in the Aramco incident in France?
I'm not sure that the incident in France was Aramco. I remember a different name. I think that it was Amoco, wasn't it?
Yeah,
Amoco. I have no knowledge of how Amoco settled their claims. I have a great deal of knowledge of how Exxon settles their claims. And unless you are a very difficult person to satisfy, it shouldn't take anywhere near 20 years. Our objective is to get some reasonable basis for the payment of a claim and paying it as promptly as we can. And if Mr. Marston wants to add anything to that, he can. He makes his living settling those claims, and I guarantee you we have never had a claim go 20 years. The answer to the question is no. The claims will be settled promptly. We have no interest in haggling, but we always have a few claims, people that you wouldn't settle with. You'd be surprised what people will claim. But people with reasonable claims don't have a thing to worry about.
Marla Atkins has a statement I believe she wishes to make.
My name is Marla Atkins. I'm here tonight representing the people of Alaska, the fishermen in this community, and myself. I'm a 30-year resident. I talk very fast. I made this statement for the news media. I am not a fisherman, but I own the only lodge in Prince William Sound. I've lived there 13 years, 20 years in the area, and work closely with the fishing community. Most Americans realize the need for our nation to produce oil, thereby keeping America self-sufficient. Most of us realize the economic inputs and the tax burden the oil companies take off of us. However, if we are to live in this world, we must work with our environment on a day-to-day basis. The larger part of Alaska, and especially the fishing industry, and our related towns, the spin-offs, are totally dependent on their renewable resource of fish, etc., for our livelihoods. In 1964, the earthquake killed off most of the clam and mussel beds in Prince William Sound in the southwest. In 1977 and 78, some 13 to 14 years later, we begin to see a noticeable and gradual comeback. I tell you, 13 years, gentlemen. With year-round residents, whales, sea life, bird life, their habitat is dependent on a good, clean environment. The possible devastation to the future salmon fry is something to consider. Our hatcheries, etc. The effects will not go away in 5 years. We're looking more like 10 to 12 years, if my experience and the fishermen in this community experience is any. 16 years ago and 13 years ago, I attended the federal hearings in Washington and Anchorage, Alaska. Promises were made to us. The complacency of the past years, the federal government, the state, and certain individual groups now, and the aftermath is what has followed with the grounding of the tanker Exxon leaves me heartsick and disillusioned. With the oil industry, our federal and state governments, and myself, for not pursuing questions and following up. I left it in my mind to the experts, and I forgot that experts are humans, and experts make errors and excuses where the dollar is involved. I realize that a spill of this magnitude is never totally prepared for, but I find that the response time, the cleanup actions, the lack of emergency, immediate contingency plans are totally unsatisfactory. The lack of the Coast Guard monitoring as each vessel leaves and enters the Valdez arm is not what we were told it would be back in the early days of the pipeline beginning. The fact that it is was ended in 1981 is unfathomable, and I think the Coast Guard should have to answer to this. The lack of any cleanup, paths in large quantities, storage areas, booms, larger pumps, routine teams, inspections, is deplorable. The fact that originally Alyeska was to have 32 storage tanks and our government settled for 18 does not set well with me as a citizen of Alaska and America. Exxon alone does not share, however, all of this burden. The ineffective cleanup of the problem areas over the spill was in place, and leading up to it is a burden that many of our state and federal agencies must share. To sum this up, the long-term devastating economic blow to Cordova, which is going to feel it more than Valdez and other communities, which has no other industry, no highway, is yet to be seen. And with all this on mind, I want to ask and be assured, and the people of Alaska do, sir, both of you from Alyeska, from Exxon, and from our federal and state agencies, I want it on record for myself and the citizens of this state that long-term follow-up jointly between this oil industry, federal and state, is set up, and you will live up to the words that you gave us back when we attended those hearings before. Future correction, immediate lack of cleanup equipment and response teams are set up, and perhaps our Lieutenant Government suggestions he made the other day followed. Perhaps Alaska should step in and handle this, and the oil companies foot the bill. Compensation in every sector for fish and related areas as it proves necessary. More rigid control and employee hiring practices for the masters and bridge personnel especially. Permanent licensed navigators from Hinchinbrook entrance to Corvallis and back, which we were promised in the beginning, sir, and you can go back over the records for that. NOAA above and underwater dates of above and underwater charts should be brought up to date on a regular basis. I've had first-hand experience in the past with them not being quite up to date. And continual Coast Guard monitoring of the vessels as they move in and out of the sound where possible, and not become complacent.